Welcome to the Dolphin Tales podcast presented by Baptist Health. I'm your host, Scott Manzi, joined as always by my co-host, Pat Sitkins, a JU baseball alum and owner of a local full-service marketing firm. Two more great guests for you today on the program, leading things off with Pat's conversation with class of 1973 graduate and men's soccer alum Frank Pace, who is a producer in Hollywood, has made documentaries, television shows, and so much more content over the years. Fascinating stories from Frank about his time at JU. Really fascinating stuff from what he has done in his long and illustrious career. You're going to love his conversation with Frank, I guarantee it. After that, my conversation with Joseph Hacker, a new member of the men's golf team. He hails from England, originally a transfer from a community college in Texas in his first year with the JU Golf program. And we chat all about his desire to come to the United States to play golf, his pro aspirations, and what his life at JU has been like so far in just the couple of short months that he has been here, and of course the weird time it is to be a college student. But fun conversation with Joe after Pat's conversation with Frank. But first, episode 20 of the Dolphin Tales podcast is presented by Baptist Health. Baptist Health is the official healthcare provider of Jacksonville University Athletics. Baptist Health, changing healthcare for good. Coming up after the break, Pat Sitkins and JU 1973 alum Frank Pace.
To stay on top of your game, it's important to take good care of yourself. And that's exactly what Baptist Primary Care doctors specialize in, helping you know the score when it comes to your health. And with more than 1,400 physicians in our network, Baptist Primary Care is your direct link to all of Baptist Health. To establish a relationship with a Baptist Primary Care doctor near you, call 202-CARE. Baptist Health, proud to be the official healthcare provider for JU Athletics.
This is Jacksonville women's basketball head coach Darnell Haney. Chenatry Chiropractic is a proud sponsor of JU Athletics, located east of downtown in the Arlington neighborhood. Chenatry Chiropractic specializes in acupuncture for pain relief and sports performance. See how their quality chiropractic care can help you with back pain, neck pain, auto accidents, sciatica, and more. For more information about Chenatry Chiropractic, please visit chanatrydc.com. Chenatry Chiropractic.
Joining me today is a man who is very committed to the university, someone who's done a lot for the university as a whole, for the program that he was a part of. He's a 1973 graduate, a JU soccer alum. I'd like to welcome today on Dolphin Tales, Mr. Frank Pace. First, I'm noticing a trend as we've gone through Dolphin Tales, and I think what we're noticing is if you want to be a producer, you have to play soccer at JU. We've had Dove Ribnick on, who was a JU soccer alum. We had Alex Boylan on last episode, We've got you. So I guess the path to becoming a producer, play soccer at JU, is that right?
It works. It works for me anyway.
I definitely want to get into that in a second. I guess to frame the interview, I want to just give a quick bio, and luckily the soccer program did my work for me since you just addressed them. Certainly something we can talk about, but they put up some of your stats, I guess, and a little bit of your bio. So I know you were a four-year goalkeeper for the university, got a degree in business, and then went on to become a television producer, producing more than 700 network TV episodes, which I'd love to get into. And you were also on the Board of Trustees from 2007 to 2016. Right. And you also answered Question Jacksonville Who, which is the documentary on Amazon. All that said, Frank, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words?
Well, I got to JU in 68, and I graduated in 72. I actually crammed 4.5 years of learning into four. Opposite way, I crammed 4.5 years into 4 years into 4.5 years learning. I was from White Plains, New York, and I came down because I wanted the warm weather. I wanted out of New York, where I was born and raised. When I got to Jacksonville, the smell of the paper mill hung heavy in the air, and there was so much hyacinth on the river, you almost could look like you could walk across it. Do you know what hyacinth is?
No.
Oh, hyacinth is really thick grass that, floats down the river. And there was so much hyacinth floating down the river that it was amazing. It literally looked like you could walk across the river on the hyacinth. I played soccer and baseball, majored in business. And I made a lot of friends there that are friends to this day. It was really a great experience for me. It even got greater in my sophomore year when Artis and Pembroke joined a basketball team. And that gave me a great experience that I never could have had before, because up until that time, I really thought that people that came from little places couldn't do big things. And then when the basketball team went all the way to the national championship game, they showed me what little people from small towns could do. And we were the little engine that could, in a lot of ways. And that year also, our soccer team went 15-0-1. So it was a good year at JU.
Good year for the program. Absolutely. Yep. Well, let's talk about the time period there. Like I said, you did the Jacksonville Who documentary. Again, it's on Amazon. For anyone, prospective, current, or alumni, it's something that you should definitely watch. A lot of people know about that period, maybe very generally speaking. I remember when I came on my recruiting trip, they talked about that basketball team. And it's obviously a big part of the legacy. Artis is still around the university, which is great. But, having gone through it, not just hearing the stories, why don't you talk a little bit about that time period, both just what was going on in the world and specifically what was going on in the university?
Well, also, I want to say it's also on, now it's on YouTube. So okay, if anybody clicks in and watches Jacksonville Who, ? In the search engine, it'll come up. And I think it's better on YouTube than on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
So there were some audio problems, I guess, on Amazon Prime, but we got it worked out on YouTube. So 68-72, I'll tell you how the project came about. A JU alum named Steve Broder was at JU at the same time. He grew up down in the beach area, and he lived in LA now. He still lives in LA now, and he approached me about doing a movie about JU basketball team. And I said, no, I didn't think there was enough of a story there. I said, come back in 6 months if you have something. Well, he came back in 6 months and he said, I said, no again. But in the intervening time, I considered whether there was another story, and there was another story of racial injustice. And by combining the two of those together, with JU having three blacks players on the basketball team, when the entire SEC conference only had one black in total, that made a big difference to me. So that made me want to do the movie, because I could tell two stories at the same time. I could tell a story of the Jacksonville racial injustice, and then I could tell a story of the remarkable achievements of the basketball team.
And again, it's an excellent documentary. Just the story. And like you said, you tell about everything that was going on, around the country, within Jacksonville, and then the story of that team and how it came together. And there's some, I'm not going to give too many spoilers, but there's some things in it that I learned that were pretty fascinating. So I know you're still very good friends with Artis and keep up with him. And so I guess let's get into, like you said, just little people doing big things, just like that team that came from a little no-name school. Talk to me a little bit about, so you're playing soccer, you're playing baseball. At what point did you say, I want to be a producer?
Well, before we do that, I want to go into the time period. I want to address the question you asked me originally. I learned a lot of things that I couldn't use in the documentary, because there's only so much time and you only got so much time to tell stories. But in 68, there was still segregation in Jacksonville. The high schools hadn't been integrated. So when Chipper Dublin came in the fall of 67, he was the first guy ever to integrate the JU basketball team. Take UCLA, for example. That was 1967. UCLA was integrated in 1927. So they had, 67 minus 27 is what? 40-year head start on JU in integrating basketball. And California had 40-year head start on Florida on integrating their school system. I mean, some of those guys, Pembroke said he never saw a white player in high school. They played against all black teams. Rusty Baldwin said he never saw a black player on other teams that he played. So there was a lot of racial injustice. One interesting thing I found out, that in 1964, the Beatles were scheduled to play a concert in the Gator Bowl. They found out that the blacks and whites were supposed to be segregated in the stands, and they refused to play the concert unless the contract was rewritten that said the crowd would be integrated. So they rewrote the contract, and they played a concert in Jacksonville in 1964, which was the first time there was an integrated crowd in Jacksonville.
Wow.
Where are you from, Scott? Pat?
I'm from Southwest Florida. So, yeah, I came up here in 2000 and back and forth, but have been here pretty much since.
Great. So that's a little bit more about the background. And also I found out about the Axe Handle Saturday, which was a brutal time in Jacksonville. People collected down by Morrison's Cafeteria in Heming Square, and they just beat the crap out of black people with axe handles. It was a terrible day.
Yeah, and I know you get into that and actually interview people that were part of that event. And with everything going on right now in the world, I know that was a big talking point, both with the university and around Jacksonville. So again, if people really want to get the background on that, as well as just that time period, again, it's a huge part of the legacy of the university. So what else from the documentary? I mean, again, people know that, the team went to the finals and it was a big turning point. I think we can all agree for the university, but what are some of the big takeaways that you have from doing that project that maybe, a current student wouldn't know, just because they weren't around for it?
Well, the reason I did the documentary is because an inordinate amount of members of that team have passed away. Vaughn Wedeking, Danny Hawkins, Chipper Dublin, at least five members of that team have passed away. And since we did the documentary, Dr. Ken Selke has passed away. And I wanted to record a legacy of that team before it was too late. So the great thing is that we all got to get, I brought everybody into Jacksonville. We all actually in 2000, what year was the hurricane? The big hurricane that hit JU? 16? 2016, well, yeah. I believe. I brought everybody in Jacksonville about 2 days after the hurricane hit. Actually, JU was closed. President Cost allowed me to use the university anyway, and he gave up his office for an interview with artists where we had some external outdoor interviews set up. But the fact that all of those guys got together in Jacksonville, some of them hadn't seen each other in 48 years, was incredible to me. And that was a marvelous feeling of satisfaction for me as a filmmaker.
That's incredible. So you talked about coming to Jacksonville, and that's, again, one of those other themes that we're seeing is a lot of people from up north coming down because the weather, the beaches, and all that. So Was it a soccer decision? Was it an academic decision? What really, solidified your decision to come to the university?
Well, I loved the late Fran Kinney. And Fran Kinney used to take me to task for saying this, but I came to Jacksonville University because they accepted me. that plus the weather and the possibility of playing soccer encouraged my admissions to Jacksonville University. But the fact that they accepted me played a big fact, because I was not a great student in high school. I was a C student, C plus student. And the fact that Jacksonville accepted me and showed faith in my ability to perform in a college classroom went a long way as far as my career development as well.
Oh, that's a great answer.
But Fran used to kick my butt. She said, "Frank, don't you say that." I said, "Fran, it's true."
That's I'm sure the academic standards have gotten a lot tighter since then. So
there is no doubt that I couldn't get into JU today. JU's becomes, and I know this from having been on the admissions committee of the Board of Trustees, JU has gotten so rigorous in its academics that it really makes me proud. I mean, I'm really proud of the great school that JU has become.
So, we talked a little bit about soccer and obviously being part of a great program then. And then we also share something in common. And both of us played baseball at JU as well. So I've got to ask about, your famous baseball story that you told me.
Well, I was a pretty good goalkeeper. I was voted the most valuable defensive player my senior year. And it's an award I took seriously. On JU, I wasn't so good. Barry Myers was the baseball coach then. And I believe him and Bill Coulthart got together. And we didn't have spring soccer at that time. We had, fall soccer, and then you would go into spring baseball season. So a lot of us played dual sports. I believe Coulthart went to Barry Myers and said, "Look, he's a big part of my team. Can you take him on a team, keep him out of trouble?" So, and I was blessed with the kind of arm that I could throw batting practice every day. So I basically went out for the baseball. I was on the baseball team. Barry kept me as the 25th man. And I pretty much threw batting practice every day. I never got a sore arm or anything. So came time for me to get into a game. And I got into a game as a pitcher in the ninth inning of a game that we were winning 13-0. I guess Barry felt, "What the hell? I got nothing to lose. I could throw him out there, give him an inning or so, and we'll see how he does." Well, right before I got the pitch, Guy Ezell, who was a big, burly player, who was a great player. He played double-A baseball for the Oakland A's, as a matter of fact. And he was a power hitter and an outfielder. He moved my foot position on the mound. So I went out there trying to work on what Guy told me instead of just throwing a ball over the plate. Well, I couldn't hit a bull in the ass with a base fiddle. I walked a couple of guys. I gave up a couple of hits. It was soon 13-4 when I hear Barry Myers yell out, "Keep it up, Pace. You'll send them home happy yet." And that was Coach Myers. When we played baseball, there was no stands. There was not. It was a chain link fence in the outfield. And there were bleachers, a small set of bleachers for both teams to sit on. So we have none of the advantages that the current teams got today, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's been an amazing transformation, even since I was there, to see Southern Oak and what they've done there and at the baseball field and the stadiums. And just the whole campus has just taken this rise in the way it looks, the way it feels, and the amenities and what they have available. It's pretty impressive.
I'll tell you a quick story about Barry Myers. Another story about Barry Myers. He used to sit on the bench and he just used to, you know, he used to yell out colloquialisms like, the Jaguars had a PA announcer like named Jeff Robinson, I believe, in the 80s. Anyway, Robinson's brother went to JU. He was a big lumbering first baseman. And he was trying to beat out a ball in the infield. And Barry Myers yells out, "Robinson, you run down the first base line like a one-legged piss ant trying to stomp out a forest fire." That was Barry Myers. And he had this habit of whenever he had to argue with an umpire, he would get right up into his face, and then he would, at the last moment, turn around like this. And he would argue with his back to the umpire. And Coach Myers was a beauty. He went on to coach, I guess. He was probably coaching at Mercer when you played against Mercer.
Okay. I'm not sure.
And now he's in the Mercer Hall of Fame.
Wow.
So that's
was it an effective technique though to turn your back to the ump?
It was hilarious because the umpires caught on and the umpires would walk away. And Barry would be standing there arguing with himself.
He was just ahead of his time. It was social distancing. You know,
he was safety protocols. He was ahead of his time, that's for sure.
So let's talk a little bit about, again, this trend that we're seeing. So apparently if you want to be a producer, you play soccer. And then, you just become a producer, right? That's all there is to it.
that's almost true. JU has made a big, big impact in the Hollywood community. My best friend, Jay Thomas, was a two-time Emmy Award-winning actor. He starred in Cheers. He starred in Murphy Brown. He starred in Mr. Holland's Opus. If you're not familiar with Jay, I just watch Mr. Holland's Opus. You will be blown away. Jay is a JU graduate. Bruce Helford created Drew Carey Show, created George Lopez, worked on Roseanne. Multiple guy. He's 73 years old. He'll work as long as he wants to work. He's there. He's there and working. Bill Hill would introduce me to the choreography coach, Carrie Coble at JU. And Carrie's had a number of students that he sent to me, that she has sent to me, and are now working in college. Melissa Thrasher is a very successful producer director out here in Los Angeles. You know, Steve Broder, as I mentioned, very successful radio jingle writer. Terrence Mann, who went to JU, originated the role of Beast in Beauty and the Beast on Broadway. Very successful actor. I mean, JU has got a terrific litany of people. I'll tell you a story. When Bruce Helford and I've worked for Bruce three times now on shows. When he and I discovered we both went to JU at the same time, he said, "I'm from Florida." Oh, I said, "I went to school in Florida." He said, "Me too." He said, Where'd you go to school? I said, "Jacksonville University." He said, "Me too. When were you there?" I said, "When Artis was there?" He said, "Me too." he said, "I can't believe you didn't see any of my plays. I was in a lot of plays." I said, "How many of my soccer games did you go to?" He said, fair enough. But we were out here working for 15 years. Didn't even know each other. And if I had known he was a JU graduate, I would have called him immediately. Alex Boylan, JU graduate.
There you go.
Bo Kribnik, JU graduate. So, you know, JU's got as rich a history in film and television as many of schools that are making their bones on films and TV schools.
There you go. Well, that's the point of, you know, this segment on Dolphin Tales is to hopefully highlight some of these people that have gone on to do incredible things, both, you know, at the university and professionally. So let's talk a little bit about that path. I mean, so you finish up, and I know a lot of people that we've talked to have had different stories. You know, some knew right away this is what they wanted to do. Some people have tried out different things and realized the corporate world wasn't for them. So what drove you to do this, and how did you start in the film industry?
Well, first of all, I was very lucky. And anybody that is successful and doesn't attribute a good portion of their success to luck is a liar. And I'll just be blatant. I talked about that a little bit in my book, If These Lips Could Talk, which is available this week on Amazon. But I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I left JU. I got an indication of what I wanted to do in high school, and JU gave me the opportunity to work on that craft, not knowing that I was working on the craft. I had written for the school newspaper in the last half of my high school senior year, and a teacher, Irene Willis, noticed something that nobody else had noticed in me before, that I actually had some ability to write. So at JU, college is an opportunity for you to try stuff and do stuff badly, because you have a four-year window to experiment, to try stuff, to find out what you like, to find out what you're good at, find out what you don't good at. So I wrote for the school newspaper. I wrote for the yearbook committee. I was practicing my writing. And I was writing some articles I read now I cringe at, but some I saw what Mrs. Willis saw in high school. And that encouraged me to continue that pursuit. So I wanted to try to be a PR guy. So I got into PR first for the Southern California Sun of the World Football League. And I met with a general manager named Curly Morrison, who is a great football player at Ohio State. He was the general manager of the team. And he said, well, I can work you, but I can't pay you. So I said, fine, I'll work for 30 days for free. After 30 days, you either hire me or you fire me. After 30 days, he did neither. But he got me a job with the Portland Storm. And I went up there and I became PR director for the Portland Storm for a half a year until they ran out of money. And then I jumped to the Chicago Winds for the second season, and they ran out of money. So I decided that that sports wasn't the kind of career that I wanted to be into. There was too many intangibles, too many ownerships. I mean, look at Doc Rivers. Doc Rivers just got fired yesterday or whenever this, I'm not sure when this is going to air, but he just got fired recently. And, you know, he's had a long, great career. But still, I wanted more stability in my life. I kept working in PR, and I went to work for a company in San Diego called the Phillips Organization, which was a small advertising and public relations firm specializing in sporting goods. Their biggest account was Ectelon. And there I hired a young writer by the name of Armin Katayan, who is now above buildings. Armin wrote the Tiger Woods book. Armin's had been a contributor to 60 Minutes. And he and I collectively started working in television because in 1979, a person by the name of Bill Rasmussen, we were trying to get racquetball on television. This is probably a boring story, but I'll go through it anyway.
Oh, yeah.
We were trying, we were trying to get racquetball on television, and Bill Rasmussen came to my office in San Diego, and he said, "I'm starting a new network, and my network is going to be 24 hours television, and we would like to put your program on the network." And I said, "Well, what's the name of the network?" And he said, "The Entertainment and Sports Programming Network, ESPN. So I took a rider with ESPN, and I started producing racquetball for television, and later a short course triathlon series called the Ironman Bud Light Echelon, the Bud Light Speedo. Speedo was another one of my clients. Speedo Bud Light Triathlon Series. And that series became an Olympic sport, and it still is an Olympic sport today. So from there, I jumped to, I was working on an account for Pony Shoes, Pony Athletic Shoes, which is a long forgotten shoe company, but was in the fight with Adidas, Nike, Converse, New Balance, Pony to be the number one shoe of the 80s. And when I went to, I was going to the studios and giving out free shoes. And I went to see a show called Bay City Blues, and I went to talk to the director of that, and the director said, "I need a baseball consultant as well. Do you know anybody?" And I said, "Me." And I walked through the door, and I just kept walking ever since.
There you go. So I know you've been part of some very well-known shows, and so if you want to toot your horn a little bit, and you know, what are some of the things besides ESPN? What are some other things that people might know that you've been part of?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, my friend Armin, was a graduation speaker at JU in 2010, 2011. So that's how some of folks may know Armin as well. But I did a show called Head of the Class, which stayed on the air for 5 years. I did a show called what else did I do? I did a show called Something Wilder, Daddy Dearest, starring Don Rickles. I did Suddenly Susan, starring Brooke Shields. Brooke, by the way, wrote the foreword for my book. Well, I just exposed myself on how that thing is standing on the wall. I did George Lopez show. I did Murphy Brown. I did the original Murphy Brown in 88 and went back in 30 years later, did the follow-up version. I did Shake It Up, which was a show which starred Zendaya and Bella Thorne. Zendaya just won an Emmy for the Best Dramatic Actress. And I did a show called Girl Meets World, which was an offshoot of Boy Meets World, which was a big hit during the 90s. And I've done four movies, including Babe Ruth, which starred my very good friend, Stephen Lang. And Stephen was the graduation speaker in maybe 2012.
There you go. That's fantastic. Excuse me. Well, you've talked a little bit about the book, and I know you have a podcast as well. So I want to dig into it quickly. Like you said, book is out this week, so probably – it's been out for about a week or so when people are watching this episode. What's the book all about?
Well, the book is about my experiences as a producer, people that I've worked with. It's not about me. It's about people I've worked with and my experience with those people. It includes stories about John Wayne, Donald Trump, Sylvester Stallone. I'm trying to read over my shoulder. Jay Thomas, of course, Don Rickles, Frank Sinatra, Candace Bergen, talks about my experiences with all these people. Some good, some not good. Thus the name, If These Lips Could Talk. These lips are finally talking.
And they're doing that on the podcast as well. And how often are you putting that out?
Wait. Oh,
there it is. Product placement, I like it.
we do a show every Saturday on all social media platforms. It's a live show. It's a four-camera video show. We switch feeds. We bring in guests from all over the country. This week coming up, we'll have a famous director Joel Zwick, whose experiences go back to Laverne and Shirley, and feature experiences. He directed My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which was the number one independent movie of all time. Next week we're having Tony O, who is a Frank Sinatra, Don Rickles confidant, and he tells us some wild stories. In upcoming weeks, we're going to have Mary McNamara, Pulitzer Prize winner from the LA Times, and we'll have Molly Ann Brasigliano, who is the queen of sports cards and sports collectibles. So we're trying to get a diverse lineup of people. One thing we don't talk about is we don't talk politics.
There you go.
So that'll
probably smart.
Yes, we figured either way we're going to alienate half of our audience, so we don't want to alienate anybody.
We do the same thing here. So, and I know you recently had artists on as well. I got to watch that one after you and I spoke originally.
Yeah,
it's a great interview, and they're long interviews, so you really get into a lot of detail. A lot of great stories. So definitely, I'll put a link in when I share this out.
Yeah,
so people can go check you out as well.
Upcoming on a 9/11 show, my co-writer Billy O'Connor is an interesting guy. He was a drug addict. He was an alcoholic. He was a bar owner. He was a Vietnam vet, and for 20 proudest years of his life. He was a New York City firefighter and was a first responder at 9/11. At the age of 58, he decided, what am I doing with myself? He had been retired from the fire department, and he had not gone to college. At 58, he enrolled in the University of Florida, got his degree in journalism, and at 62 years old, he became a journalist and a stand-up comic. He hasn't had a drink in 15 years. He's just a fascinating, fascinating person and a great writer. So my point in bringing up Billy was he was a first responder at 9/11. We did a 9/11 show, which I invite anybody to watch because our previous podcasts are all archived on YouTube and Facebook. We had Billy on, and we had two other first responders who were captains at 9/11. And it was a remarkable, ripping, moving story. And when I was in New York doing Murphy Brown, I had a lot of time on my hands on the weekends because my family was in Los Angeles. So I went down to the 9/11 Memorial, and I went into the museum. I recommend it for anybody. I mean, it's a sobering experience for anybody who's ever been alive. I'm at a loss for words. It was just a very, very moving experience. And my heart goes out to the many people that died and the many firefighters who are still dying to this day, because I think there were like 250,000 contaminants released into the air that day. And I remember one of the firefighters said, whenever we got a phone call, it used to be a pause for a cause to celebration. It used to be somebody retired or somebody was getting a medal. But now the phone rings and I automatically assume it's another person passing away. So 9/11 is still having an effect today. But it's a great experience for anybody. And on November, the week following Veterans Day, we're going to have, Billy was a Vietnam vet, we're going to have a retired general and a retired lieutenant colonel on to talk about Veterans Day and the experiences that means to us. I'm a part of the Vietnamese era. I didn't have bone spurs, but I got out of military because I had a bad wrist. And ironically, I broke my wrist in a soccer game that I was supposed to not be playing soccer in, one of those spring games where I was supposed to be playing baseball. Barry Myers gave us a Saturday off. So I went down to the University of Florida and played in a city league game, an amateur game, and I broke my wrist, and that kept me out of the service. It also kept me from throwing batting practice for the rest of the year.
The 9/11 stories that you're talking about, you know, my wife and I were just talking about that and how, you know, to us, it's just, it's a very weird thing to realize that the students that are at JU now were either not born or just born. And so for them to not really understand the impact that that had on so many of us. And, you know, it's one of those things, like I remember growing up, you know, people talking about, where were you when JFK was shot? And everyone knew. And I just always thought that was weird that people would know where they were. And I know exactly where I was. I was on campus. I was down in the housing office with my roommate talking about just moving some stuff around. And the lady sent us back to our rooms. And we watched it on TV in our dorm room. I was at JU. And so it's just, it's very important, I think, to continue to tell those stories for the people that, you know, we're either babies or we're not alive when that happened. So I applaud you guys for doing that. And I think it's something that people absolutely should watch.
Well, it's incredible to me to realize how many people weren't alive the last time a man walked on the moon. You weren't alive. It's been almost 50 years since man walked on the moon. And my good friend, my two good friends, Max Scott, who was a JU graduate, who I was on the board of trustees with, and her husband, David Scott, was the first man to drive on the moon. And you know, that's the type of people that we have associated with JU. But to think that David's now 88 and walked on the moon and drove on the moon. It's incredible for me to know that with all of our technical capabilities, we haven't put a man on the moon since. Apollo 17, Gene Cernan was the last man to walk on the moon. Do you know Gene Cernan's name? No, you know?
I don't.
No, you know the name of the first man to walk on the moon, right?
Sure, of course. It's like you said, it's we're in such amazing company with the alumni that are out there, you know, university wide, but also for our purposes here on Dolphin Tales in the athletic department. And so the more that we can tell these kind of stories and introduce people to people like you, Frank, you know, I think it's important because all of these individual stories are what make the university so special. It's what draws people. It's what keeps people connected to the university. And like you said, you know, you go through and you make friends and you make lifelong friends. So it really is just an incredible environment and experience.
Yeah. And I will tell you that if it wasn't for people like Tim Cost, Chris Sapienza, who's now the provost, who's become a very good friend, and the board of trustees, those are the people that made Jacksonville WHO a reality. Because Tim was, I call him Tim, well, you call him President Cost, but Tim was so terrifically supportive of us. And the board of trustees, many of who went to other schools, people like Peter Galone, Steve Kegler, Andy Moran's a JU graduate, but they were board of trustees people. And I had to drum up the money to do Jacksonville WHO. I didn't make a penny on Jacksonville WHO. I did it as a labor of love because I wanted the story out there. But those trustees, Chuck Woodhouse, John Harrison, those trustees allowed me, they donated the money. I'll let you know how much it was. They donated $250,000 to allow me to make that movie. And with the help of the JU people in Los Angeles, I was able to make a movie that should have cost $600,000 for $250,000 just because of the support of people like Peter Galone, who went to Fordham, Steve Kegler, who went to another place out of JU. So Chuck Woodhouse, who went to University of Virginia, all of those people helped Jacksonville University become what Jacksonville University has become. So again,
that's great, Frank.
Good for them.
Absolutely. For them. Well, Frank, I can't thank you enough for coming by. I want to, again, thank you for being on the show. Absolutely, everyone who's watching this, go pick up If These Lips Could Talk by our own Frank Pace. Good luck
with
the book.
By the way, there's a great story, and I'm going to talk about to the soccer team, or I've already talked to the soccer team, but there's a great story about I coached high school soccer for 15 years, and there's a great story on how our soccer team became the number one team in the nation. And it's a little bit off task, but it'll tell you a little about the kind of people that I'm drawn to, the kind of people that I work with, the kind of people that I love. And that's what this book is all about. So please pick up a copy of the book if you can and watch on Saturdays.
There you go.
A Mick, a Mook, and a Mike is the name of the podcast.
There you go, Frank. Well, Frank, thank you again for coming on. Next time you're in town, please stop by. We're going to bring the show on campus now that things are getting a little bit more settled on campus. So next time you're in town, you're always welcome back, and hopefully we can talk about the success of the book and anything else.
With that, I'll say see you next time.
The Hampton Inn Oceanfront Jacksonville Beaches location is perfect for everything from a weekend getaway, a corporate conference, or even a beautiful beach wedding. Our heated lagoon-style pool with cascading waterfalls and rock grottos sets the mood for rest and relaxation. Our unique event space and full-service catering department offers everything you need for any special event. Join us at the Tides Beach Bar and Grill, where you can enjoy the ocean breeze and your favorite libation. Call the Hampton Inn Oceanfront for more details at 904-241-2311.
With over 25 years of insurance-related auto accident and personal injury experience, the law offices of George Hunter PA have the experience and knowledge when you need it most. For others, it's just business. For us, it's personal. Call us today at 1-833-221-HURT. The law offices of George Hunter PA, a proud partner of Jacksonville University Athletics. Joining me today on Dolphin Tales, Joseph Hacker. Joe, thanks so much for taking the time to sit here and chat with me here today.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for getting in contact with me. I look forward to the meeting.
You are a member of the men's golf team, first year member of the men's golf team. It's been interesting because so many of my interviews over the course of the last several months have been with returning student athletes to JU, but for you, your entire experience has just been in the last couple of weeks or so. You don't really know JU from years before or anything like that. What has your first taste of life as a Dolphin been like for these for this past few weeks?
First, it's my first 2 months here. I'm actually really enjoying it, despite all the different situations and scenarios we've been put under. Looking at it from a golfing perspective, I think it's a great place for me to hone my skills in and just really prepare for the future and what it has to hold. Everything. I can't see any negative things about JU so far. And I'm just looking forward to the spring, to be honest, to get back competing with the team, because obviously our full season got cancelled.
Right.
Which has been a shame, but.
No doubt. Obviously, that creates a completely different type of mindset compared to how golf is kind of year round. I mean, I know technically college golf doesn't compete in the summer, but you're used to going out there and competing all the time. I mean, you've been able to kind of get out and make the most of opportunities as of late, regardless of the fact that there aren't official events on the calendar, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's just been sort of just a turmoil of events this fall. I don't think anyone's really used to it. But, yeah, everything's just been cancelled this fall. We do have a couple of individual tournaments, which is good, just to get that competition mindset, keep that ticking over. But, yeah, just really this fall, I think it's just preparing for the spring. There's not much going on in terms of golf tournaments that are really big for JU. And yeah, that's really what this fall is, I think, for golf-wise.
How do you get better without the amount of events that you're used to playing or that any college golfer is used to playing at this point in the year? How do you use practice to your advantage?
It's obviously a lot harder because, well, personally for me, you gain the most experience and knowledge when you're under the gun and under the biggest pressure, which is only, you can only get that from tournaments. But it's good that we have a good team, all competitive at JU. So we always play games, just competing against each other, pushing each other on. And yeah, just that competitive mindset, just into practice, just always wanting to beat each other, things like that, even on the golf course, throwing in some consequences like playing for press ups or things like that, just to get like a competitive edge, just gain some pressure. Obviously it's not going to be the same as tournaments, but we're doing the best we can for the situation.
You said that you've enjoyed your time, albeit brief, at JU thus far. A great chance for you to grow as a golfer for what's next. What is so attractive about Jacksonville University when it comes to playing golf here?
For me, coming from England, one of the main reasons I wanted to come over here to America was the weather, because obviously in the winter back home it's not great. Also the golf courses and the facilities that we have access to at JU. We have access to TPC Sawgrass. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but that's a really well-known golf course. And also just the history and the players that have been here. And also the coach, Jamie, he's attracted me. And yeah, I really wanted to work with him. I just thought that this was a great fit for me. Just quite a smallish university, which sort of suits me. And yeah, Florida, you can't really, especially around the winter months, you can't really beat the weather. So
you mentioned TPC Sawgrass. Anybody who lives around here is at least casually familiar with it, and everyone knows the world famous Island 17 green. Yeah. How many balls have you put in the water around on that hole so far?
I haven't played that course yet, the stadium. So they have two courses there, but I have had a glimpse of it. It looks daunting. I'm looking forward to playing it hopefully soon.
I hope they get it. I hope they get it open for you guys to go around there and take a crack at it, so that you can. I want to hear all about it because I, you know, you see so many people that try their hand at it and how difficult it is. But Dyes Valley is no walk in the park either. And of course, that's the home to one of the spring events for you. Yeah. All. What do you think about that track?
Well, what I've been told is that course is actually in better shape all year round compared to the stadium course. So it's actually always in great condition. We do have a big event there early on in the spring semester. So, you know, it's just a great test, just great to practice your game and test it. And yeah, that whole course is just sets up difficult and challenging, which is good for me because you always want to be pushed and just test your game.
You mentioned you are from England. You're from Jersey, an island off the coast of England. What can you tell me about that? What's the pitch if you're the Chamber of Commerce and describing Jersey to us?
So Jersey is an island in between England and France. There's a couple of islands there called it's known as the Channel Islands. So Jersey's the biggest island out of those. It's very, very small, 9 by 5 miles wide, maybe 110,000 people. Yeah, it's just really, really small. That's one of the reasons why I sort of wanted to get away from it, because obviously there's only so much you can do there in terms of sport and your level of improvement. Now, I just sort of wanted to get away from there and just test myself in a bigger ocean, more competition, things like that. But yeah, it's a great place to grow up, things like that. It's just quite small.
You could run around the whole thing, right?
You can, yeah, they do annual walks, things like that. Maybe takes 15 hours ish to walk it.
Okay.
42 miles, I think.
Yeah. That's incredible. What about the, I got to imagine that there's pretty good wind that you're dealing with trying to play golf maybe on that island.
Yeah, so my home course is maybe about 200, 300 feet right on the coast. So it always has at least 20 miles an hour wind that we always have to challenge to. There's always, or not always, it's always a challenging course where I am. It's like a European tour setting, or they used to have a European tour event there. And yeah, anywhere you go really on the island, it's near the ocean, so you're going to get a lot of wind. You just have to find your way to get around it and work with it.
What does that, if anything, do to help you in your game? If you're so used to playing with strong winds in any direction, are you able to kind of take that and use it no matter where you're playing?
Yeah, I think playing with the wind definitely helps you be more creative with your shots. It's not just like a straightforward where there's no wind and you just attack the pin. You sort of have to find your way and just create shots, see shots. And I think that helps you with your golf game anywhere you go, because you're obviously going to be faced with different situations and things like that where you have to be more imaginative and things like that. Obviously, playing in the wind, you have to keep it quite low. So one big thing for me was just working on my trajectories, which has helped with my distance control and things like that. But yeah, I think the main thing is just being creative in the wind.
So you come over to America, you played a year at Midland Community College, which is in Midland, Texas, for those that don't know. Had you had any experience in the States prior to going to play at Midland?
No, I haven't. No, that was sort of my first year in America, American college, things like that. So everything was quite new to me there.
And you end up in Texas, of all places. I mean, quite the place to land.
There was two English guys on the team there who were a year older than me. I knew them from going to competitions in England over the summer and things like that. So I just got talking to them, and they spoke to the coach and said that I was interested in going to America. And yeah, I just spoke to the coach and he gave me a good offer that I liked, and off I went.
What was the most interesting part of your first year in the United States living in Texas?
I would just say just a huge cultural change to what I'm used to. Everything from food to living to just everything. It's just a completely different environment. And I think that has helped me become more of like an all-round person rather than staying in Jersey and being a bit more narrow-minded. I'm sort of just widened my horizons, and I've just become an all-round better person, I think, from that experience.
Have you noticed a change in Jacksonville versus in Midland?
Golf-wise, I have, yeah, definitely. I think that because coming from a junior college to a Division One division or school, I think that the competition is a lot higher here. You sort of could get away with iffy tournament results, but you know, you really have to play well here to even finish in the top 15, top 20, which is what I want, because obviously from here, stepping up to, say, the Corn Ferry Tour, the PGA Tour, the European Tour, it becomes that little bit easier.
So your goals are professional golf after this. I'm always fascinated, because at JU we have had quite a few guys go on to play in the different levels of professional golf over the years. How are you? I mean, this is obviously the next step, right? You're at the Division I school, so you're learning there. Where do you see the step coming after that? When do you know that maybe you're ready?
So I'll just keep my amateur status for as long as I can. Maybe it depends how well I'm playing after my JU time here. If I feel like my game's ready, I'll turn professional and I'll try to get a tour card or get some invites somewhere. But if I don't feel like I'm ready, I'm just going to keep my amateur status for a year or two and just really see how it goes. I think or what I've heard from previous people that I've spoke to, it sort of just comes a time where you just feel like you're ready from within. It just, there's like a sense of calmness and things like that. It's hard to describe, but I think that's only, you only know that yourself when you're ready.
So you have a relationship with Ian Woosnam, a former winner on the PGA Tour and European Tour. How did that come about?
Pretty much just from practicing and playing at my home golf club. He's an honorary member there, so I see him a lot over the summer. And he's just took me under his wing, just giving me loads of tips, mentally, physically, on the golf course, course management, anything really to do with golf. And I'm really intrigued about, obviously, his experiences, because he's done everything in the game. He's world number one, won the Masters and things like that. And he's just been a great help, just to sort of pick his brain and just get everything I can from him to use that to my advantage, just to become a better person, a better golfer.
Do you have a story of maybe some advice that he has given you that stands out?
The one thing that he says, or that stuck in my mind, is self-belief. he, from his experiences, he, I think he tried six or seven times to get his tour card, and he would just keep grinding, going to the Monday qualifying, and just, he just kept believing that he would eventually get there one day. And yeah, he eventually got his card, and I think the rest was history for him. I think self-belief is a major factor. If you don't believe in yourself, I don't think you really go anywhere. No one else is going to believe for you. You have to do it from within.
And a game like golf too, where the mental aspect is such a major piece of it. I mean, it makes so much sense to sit there and preach believing in oneself, to have that kind of confidence, because if you go out there and you don't think you can get it done, I mean, do you have any chance of getting it done? It doesn't feel like it.
Yeah, exactly. I think not a lot of people understand how much mentally demanding golf is. I think you only really understand it when you get to quite a high level, because there's so many golfers, even in the top 2,000 or 3,000 in the world, their ability all is the same. It's just that mental edge is what separates the top from the not so good and not achieving as much.
Well, it feels like anybody can swing a club, or to be a hacker, not to make a pun on your last name, but to those that can separate themselves and become truly great at this game, that's what, like you said, separates the good from everyone else. So it sounds like you're on your way to that, and hopefully you're able to build that camaraderie, get better throughout the course of the fall, and then as a team, you all are ready to hit the ground running come 2021 in the spring semester. What's one moment early on here in your JU career that has stood out to you? Anything that you guys have been able to do, practice, anything like that?
I couldn't really think of one moment, but I would definitely say just the camaraderie with the team, just all wanting to push each other. I think that's just one thing that stood out for me, because I think you improve a lot quicker when you're surrounding yourself with better players. So I think that experience for me, just always being around your teammates, whether it's in the gym or the practice area or whatever, you're always pushing each other, which is one thing that just stood out for me.
Joe Hacker, he's a new member of the men's golf team at Jacksonville University. Thanks so much for joining me here today on Dolphin Tales.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
At DoubleTree, they're known for their delicious warm chocolate chip cookies baked fresh daily. Their cookies represent their constant dedication to the guest experience and is a thoughtful touch that ensures you feel special and cared for throughout your stay. Book your stay today at DoubleTree by Hilton Jacksonville Riverfront, a proud partner of Jacksonville Athletics.
Your local Napa Auto Care Center is independently owned, operates by a written code of ethics, and provides service you can trust. Put your vehicle in the care of ASE-certified technicians in your neighborhood. They're backed by Napa. Quality parts, national warranties. That's Napa know-how. Your Napa Auto Care Center might just be the treated me fairly, I love those guys place you've been looking for your vehicle. Stop by today at
jacksnapa.com. Special thanks to both of our guests who appeared today on the Dolphin Tales podcast. First, Frank Pace, men's soccer and 1973 alum and Hollywood producer. And then after that, Joe Hacker, sophomore member of the men's golf program. This has been episode 20 of the Dolphin Tales podcast presented by Baptist Health. For my co-host, Pat Sitkins, I'm Scott Manzi, saying so long, stay safe, and we look forward to bringing you more great Jacksonville University athletic stories next time.